Side 5. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 140. She told him later that as soon as he took her wrist that night, she came. And the first time he touched her cunt, squeezed Jessica's soft cunt through her knickers, the trembling began again high in her thighs, growing, taking her over. She came twice before cock was ever officially put inside cunt, and this is important to both of them, though neither has figured out why exactly. Whenever it happens, though, the light always gets very red for them. Once they met at a tea shop. She was wearing a red sweater with short sleeves, and her bare arms glowed red by her sides. She hadn't any makeup on, the first time he'd seen her so. Walking to the car, she takes his hand and puts it for a moment lightly between her moving legs. Roger's heart grows erect and comes. That's really how it feels. Up sharply to skin level in a V around his center line, washing over his nipples. It is love. It is amazing. Even when she isn't there after a dream at a face in the street that might against chance be Jessica's, Roger can never control it. He's in its grasp. About Beaver, or Jeremy, as he is known to his mother, Roger tries not to think any more than he has to. Of course, he agonizes over technical matters. She cannot possibly, can she, be doing the same things with Jeremy? Does Jeremy ever kiss her cunt, for example? Could that prig actually, does she reach around as they're fucking, eh, and slide a mischievous finger, his English rose, into Jeremy's asshole? Stop, stop this. But does she suck his cock? Has he ever had his habitually insolent face between her lovely buttocks? No use. It's youthful folly time here, and you're better off up at the Tivoli watching Maria Montez and John Hall or looking for leopards or peccaries in Regent's Park Zoo and wondering if it'll rain before 4:30. The time Roger and Jessica have spent together, totaled up, still only comes to hours. And all their spoken words to less than one average chafe memorandum. And there is no way, first time in his career, that the statistician can make these figures mean anything. Together they are a long skin interface, flowing sweat, close as muscles and bones can press, hardly a word beyond her name or his. Apart is for all their flip-flim dialogue, scenarios they make up to play alone for themselves in the nights with the Beaufort's door knocking against her sky, with his wind humming among the loops of barbed wire down along the beach. The Mayfair Hotel. We are quite the jet-propelled one, aren't we, only half an hour late? Well, Wrens and Naffy girls, jeweled young widows, side-glancing on by, I'm sure you've put the time to good use. Time enough for several assignations, he replies, looking elaborately at his watch worn World War II style on the inside of his wrist, and by now, I should say, a confirmed pregnancy or two, if not indeed. Ah, she blithely jumps, but upward, not on. That reminds me. Yeah, Roger reeling back to a potted plant, among the lilting saxophones of Roland Peachy and his orchestra playing, There I Said It Again, and cowering. So that's on your mind, if mind is the word I want. They confuse everyone. They look so innocent. People immediately want to protect them, censoring themselves away from talk of death, business, duplicity when Roger and Jessica are there. It's all shortages, songs and boyfriends, films and blouses. With her hair pulled back of her ears, her soft chin in profile, she looks only 9 or 10. Alone by windows, blinking into the sun, turning her head on the light counterpane, coming in tears, child's reddening, wrinkling face about to cry, going, oh, oh. One night in the dark, quilt and cold refuge of their bed, drowsing to and fro himself, he licked Jessica to sleep. When she felt his first warm breaths touch her labia, she shivered and cried like a cat. Two or three notes, it seemed, that sounded together, hoarse, haunted, blowing with snowflakes remembered from around nightfall. Trees outside sifting the wind. Out of her sight the lorries forever rushing down the streets and roads, behind houses, across canals or river, beyond the simple park. Oh, and the dogs and cats who went padding in the fine snow. pictures, well, scenes keep flashing in, Roger. By themselves, I mean, I'm not making them. A bright swarm of them is passing by against the low isotonic glimmer of the ceiling. He and she lie and breathe mouth up. His soft cock drools down around his thigh, the downhill one closest to Jessica. The night room heaves a sigh. Yes, heaves a sigh. Old-fashioned comical room. Oh, me, I'm hopeless. Born a joker, never change. Flirting away through the mirror frame in something green-striped, pantalooned, and ruffled. Meantime, though, it is quaint. Most rooms today hum, you know, have been known also to breathe. Yes, even wait in hushed expectancy. And that ought to be the rather sinister tradition here. Long, slender creatures, heavy perfume and capes in rooms assailed by midnight, pierced with spiral stairways, blue-petaled pergolas, an ambience in which no one, however provoked or out of touch, my dear young lady, ever heaves a sigh. It is not done. But here, oh, this young lady, checked gingham, ragged eyebrows grown wild, red velvet. On a dare once, she took off her blouse, motoring up on the trunk road near Lower Beeding. My God, she's gone insane. What is this? Why do they all come to me? Well, ha-ha, Jessica twirling the necktie of her army blouse like a stripper. You, said I was afraid to, didn't you? Called me cowardly, cowardly custard or something, as I recall. No brassiere, of course. She never wears one. Look here, glaring sideways. Do you know you can get arrested? Never mind you, just occurring to him here. I'll get arrested. They'll blame it all on you, la la, lower teeth edging out in a mean girl's smile. I'm just an innocent lamb, and this, flinging a little arm out, striking light from the fair hairs on her forearm, her small breasts bouncing free, this Roger the Rake, here this awful beast makes me perform these degrading... Meantime, the most gigantic lorry Roger has ever seen in his life has maneuvered steel shuddering nearby, and now not only the driver, but also several, well, what appear to be horrid midgets in strange operetta uniforms, actually, some sort of Central European government in exile, all of them crammed somehow into the high-set cab, all are staring down, scuffling like piglets on a sow for position, eyes popping, swarthy, mouths leaking spit to take in the spectacle of his Jessica Swanlake scandalously bare-breasted, and himself desperately looking to slow down and drop behind the lorry, except that now, behind Roger, pressing him on, in fact, at a speed identical with the lorry's, has appeared, oh shit, it is a military police car. He can't slow down, and if he speeds up, they'll really get suspicious. Jesse, please get dressed. Would you, love? Making a show of looking for his comb, which is, as usual, lost, suspect is known as a notorious tenophile. The driver of the huge, loud lorry now tries to get Roger's attention, the other midgets crowding at the windows calling, hey, hey, and emitting oily, guttural laughs. Their leader speaks English with some liquid, unspeakably nasty European accent. A lot of winking and nudging up there now, too. Mister, I, you, wait a minute, eh? More laughter. Roger in the rearview mirror sees English cop faces, pink with rectitude, red insignia, leaning, bobbing, consulting, turning sharply now and then to stare ahead at the couple in the Jaguar who are acting so... What are they doing, Prigsbury? Can you make it out? Appears to be a man and a woman, sir. Ass. And it's out with the black binoculars. Through rain, then through dreaming glass, green with the evening. And herself in a chair, old-fashioned, bonneted, looking west over the deck of earth, inferno red at its edges, and further in the brown and gold clouds. Then, suddenly, night. The empty rocking chair lit, sharing chalk blue by, is it the moon or some other light from the sky? Just the hard chair, empty now, in the very clear night, and this cold light coming down. The images go, flowering in and out, some lovely, some just awful. But she's snuggled in here with her lamb, her Roger, and how she loves the line of his neck all at once so... Why, there it is right there. The back of his bumpy head like a boy of tens. She kisses him up and down the sour, salt reach of skin that's taken her so, taken her night-lit along this high tendoning, kisses him as if kisses were flowing breath itself, and never ending. One morning, he had not seen her for about a fortnight. He woke in his hermit's cell at the White Visitation, with a hard-on, scratchy eyelids, and a long, pale brown hair tangled in his mouth. It wasn't one of his own hairs, it wasn't anybody's he could think of but Jessica's. But it couldn't be. He hadn't seen her. He sniffed a couple of times, then sneezed. Morning developed out the window. His right canine ached. He unreeled the long hair, beaded with saliva, tooth tartar, mouth breather's morning fur, and stared at it. How'd it get here? Eerie, dearie. A bit of the je ne sais quoi de sinistre, all right. He had to piss, shuffling to the lavatory. His graying government flannel tucked limply inside the cord of his pajamas, it came to him. What if it's some mauve turn-of-the-century tale of ghostly revenge, and this hair here's some first step? Oh, paranoia? You should have seen him going through all the combinations as he moved around, doing lavatory things among the stumbling, farting, razor-scraping, hacking, sneezing, and snot-crusted inmates of Psy Section. Only later in this did he even begin to think of Jessica, of her safety. Thoughtful Roger. What if she died in the night, an accident at the magazines, with this hair the only goodbye her ghostly love had been able to push back through to this side, to the only one who'd ever mattered? Some spider statistician, his eyes had actually filled with tears before the next idea. Oh, oh boy. Turn off that faucet, Dorset, and get hip to this. He stood half-stooped over the washbasin, paralyzed, putting his worry for Jessica on hold for a bit, wanting very much to look back over his shoulder, even into the old mirror, you know, see what they're up to, but too frozen to risk even that. Now. Oh, yes, a most superb possibility has found seedbed in his brain, and here it is. What if they are all these Psy Section freaks here, ganged up on him in secret? Okay? Yes, suppose they can see into your mind. Eh, and how about... what if it's hypnotism, eh? Jesus, then a whole number of other occult things, such as astral projection, brain control. Nothing occult about that. Secret curses for impotence, boils, madness, yeah, potions. As he straightens at last and back in his mind's eyes to his office now, glances very gingerly at the coffee mess. Oh, God. Psychic unity with the controlling agency, such that Roger would be he and he Roger. Yes, yes, a number of these notions rambling through his mind here, none of them really pleasant either, especially inside this staff latrine. With Gavin Trefoil's face this morning colored bright magenta, a clover blossom flashing in the wind, Ronald Cherry Coke hawking fine marbled amber phlegm into the basin. What's all this? Who are all these people? Freaks! Freaks! He's surrounded. They've been out there night and day all the war long, tapping his brain, telepaths, witches, satanic operators of all descriptions, tuning in on everything, even when he and Jessica are in bed fucking. Try to hold it down, old man. Panic if you must, but later, not here. Faint washroom light bulbs deepen the thousands of old clustered water and soap spots on the mirrors to an interfeathering of clouds of skin and smoke as he swings his head past, lemon and beige, oil smoke black and twilight brown in here, very loosely crumbled. That's the texture. Lovely morning, World War II. All he can keep in front of his mind are the words, I want a transfer, kind of humming tunelessly at the mirror. Yes, sir, got to put in a chit right away. I'll volunteer for duty in Germany's what I'll do. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Right, there was an ad only Wednesday in the classified section of Nazis in the News, sandwiched between a Merseyside labor branch that was looking for a publicist and a London advertising agency with positions open immediately on Demob, they said. This ad in the middle was placed by some arm of the G5-to-be, trying to round up a few re-education experts. Vital, vital stuff. Teach the German beast about the Magna Carta, sportsmanship, that sort of thing, eh? Out inside the works of some neurotic Bavarian cuckoo clock of a village, were elves streaking in out of the forests at night to leave subversive handbills at door and window. Anything. Door and window. Anything. Roger groping back to his narrow quarters. Anything at all's better than this. That's how bad it was. He knew he'd feel more at home in mad Germany with the enemy than here in Psy's section. The time of year makes it even worse. Christmas. Bwiach, clutching to his stomach. Jessica was all that made it human or tolerable. Jessica. He was taken over then for half a minute, shivering and yawning in his long underwear, soft, nearly invisible in the December dawn enclosure, among so many sharp edges of books, chiefs and flimsies, charts and maps. And the chief one, red pockmarks on the pure white skin of Lady London, watching over all, wait, disease on skin. Does she carry the fatal infection inside herself? Are the sites predestined? And does the flight of the rocket actually follow from the fated eruption latent in the city? But he can't hold it, no more than he understands Pointsman's obsession with the reversal of sound stimuli. And please, please, can't we just drop it for a bit? Visited, not knowing till it passed how clearly he was seeing the honest half of his life that Jessica was now, how fanatically his mother, the war, must disapprove of her beauty, her cheeky indifference to death institutions he'd not so long ago believed in, her unflappable hope, though she hated to make plans, her exile from childhood, though she refused ever to hold on to memories. His life had been tied to the past. He'd seen himself a point on a moving wave front, propagating through sterile history, a known past, a projectable future. But Jessica was the breaking of the wave. Suddenly there was a beach, the unpredictable, new life. Past and future stopped at the beach. That was how he'd set it out. But he wanted to believe it, too, the same way he loved her, past all words, believe that no matter how bad the time, nothing was fixed. Everything could be changed, and she could always deny the dark sea at his back, love it away. And, selfishly, that from a somber youth, squarely founded on death, along for death's ride, he might with her find his way to life and to joy. He'd never told her. He avoided telling himself, but that was the measure of his faith, as this seventh Christmas of the war came wheeling in another charge at his skinny, shivering flank. She trips, fussing about the dormitory, bothering other girls for puffs off of stale woodbines, nylon repair kits, sparrow-bright, war-wise cracks passing for sympathy. Tonight she'll be with Jeremy, her lieutenant. But she wants to be with Roger. Except that, really, she doesn't. Does she? She can't remember ever being so confused. When she's with Roger, it's all love, but at any distance, any at all, Jack, she finds that he depresses and even frightens her. Why? On top of him in the wild nights, riding up and down his cock, her axis, trying herself to stay rigid enough not to turn to cream taper wax and fall away, melting to the coverlet, coming, there's only room for Roger, Roger, oh love, to the end of breath. But out of bed, walking, talking, his bitterness, his darkness, run deeper than the war, the winter. He hates England, so hates the system, gripes endlessly. Says he'll migrate when the war's over. Stays inside his paper cynic's cave, hating himself. And does she want to bring him out, really? Isn't it safer with Jeremy? She tries not to allow this question in too often, but it's there. 3 years with Jeremy. He might as well be married. 3 years ought to count for something. Daily small stitches and easings. She's worn old Beaver's bathrobes, brewed his tea and coffee, sought his eye across lorry parks, day rooms and rainy mud fields when all the day's mean, dismal losses could be rescued in the one look, familiar, full of trust, in a season when the word is invoked for quaintness or a minor laugh. And to rip it all out, 3 years, for this erratic, self-centered boy, really? Weepers. He's supposed to be past 30. He's years older than she. He ought to have learned something, surely. A man of experience. The worst of it's that she has no one to talk to. Politics of this mixed battery, the professional incest, the unwholesome obsessions with who said what to whom in the spring of 1942, for God's sake, outside of Grafty Green, Kent, or someplace, and who ought to have answered what but didn't, but told someone else instead, thus provoking hatreds that have thrived wonderfully down to the present day. 6 years of slander, ambition and hysteria make confiding anything to anyone around here an act of pure masochism. Girl in distress, Jess, Maggie Dunkirk on the way by smoothing her gauntlets. On the tannoy, a BBC swing band is blaring hotly syncopated Christmas music. Got a fag, Mag? Pretty automatic by now, you guess, Jess? Well, Thought it looked somewhat like a bloody Garbo film around here. Not at all the usual nicotine starvation. Sorry, wrong again. Ta-ta. Oh, be on your way. Thinking about me Xmas shopping. What are you getting the beaver, then? Concentrating on gartering her nylons, the older pair, up in front, down in back, mnemonically stirring in wafts among her fingers, laundry white, puckered elastic being stretched fine and tangent now to the gentle front curve of her thigh, suspender clips glittering silver under or behind her lacquered red fingernails, passing like distant fountains behind red topiary trees, Jessica replies, a pipe, I suppose. Near her battery one night, driving somewhere in Kent, Roger and Jessica came upon a church, a hummock in the dark upland lamp-lit growing out of the earth. It was Sunday evening and shortly before Vespers. Men in greatcoats, in oilskins, in dark berets they slipped off at the entrance, American flyers in leather lined with sheep's wool, a few women in clinking boots and wide-shouldered swagger coats, but no children, not a child in sight, just grown-ups, trudging in from their bomber fields, balloon bivouacs, pillboxes over the beach, through the Norman doorway shaggy with wintering vines. Jessica said, "Oh, I remember," but didn't go on. She was remembering other Advents, and hedges snowy as sheep from her window, and the star ready to be pasted up on the sky again. Roger pulled over, and they watched the scuffed and dun military going into evensong. The wind smelled of fresh snow. "We ought to be home," she said after a bit. "It's late." "We could just pop in here for a moment." Well, that surprised her, but death, after weeks of his snide comments, his unbeliever's annoyance with the others in Psy Section he thought were out to drive him dotty as they were, and his scroogery growing as shopping days till Xmas dwindled. "You're not supposed to be the sort," she told him. But she did want to go in. Nostalgia was heavy in tonight's snow sky. Her own voice ready to betray her and run to join the waits whose carols we're so apt to hear now in the distances. These days of Advent dropping one by one. Voices piping across frozen downs where the sown minds crowd thick as plums in a pudding. Often above sounds of melting snow, winds that must blow not through Christmas air but through the substance of time would bring her those child voices, singing for sixpences. And if her heart wasn't ready to take on quite all the stresses of her mortality and theirs, at least there was the fear that she was beginning to lose them. That one winter she would go running to look, out to the gate to find them, run as far as the trees, but in vain, their voices fading. They walked through the tracks of all the others in the snow, she gravely on his arm, wind blowing her hair to snarls, heels slipping once on ice. "To hear the music," he explained. Tonight's scratch choir was all male, epauletted shoulders visible under the wide necks of the white robes, and many faces nearly as white with the exhaustion of soaked and muddy fields, mid-watches, cables strummed by the nervous balloons sunfishing in the clouds, tents whose lights inside shone nuclear at twilight, soul-like, through the cross-hatched walls, turning canvas to fine gauze, while the wind drummed there. Yet there was one black face, the countertenor, a Jamaican corporal taken from his warm island to this, from singing his childhood along the rum-smoky saloons of High Holborn Street, where the sailors throw mammoth red firecrackers. Quarter of a stick of dynamite, man, over the swinging doors and run across the street giggling, or come walking out with high-skirted girls, girls of the island, Chinese and French girls, lemon peels crushed in the gutters of the streets scented the early mornings where he used to sing, "Oh, have you seen my darling Lola, with a shape like a bottle of Coca-Cola?" Sailors running up and down in the brown shadows of alleys, flapping at neckerchief and pants leg, and the girls whispering together and laughing. Each morning, he counted out half a pocketful of coins of all nations. From palmy Kingston, the intricate needs of the Anglo-American Empire, 1939 to 1945, had brought him to this cold field-mouse church, nearly an earshot of a northern sea he'd hardly glimpsed in crossing, to a compline service, a program tonight of plain song in English, forays now and then into polyphony, Thomas Tallis, Henry Purcell, even a German macaronic from the 15th century attributed to Heinrich Zuso. In dulci jubilo, nun singet und seid froh. Unsers Herzens wohne leicht in principio. Leuchtet vor die Sonne, matris in gremio, Alpha S et O. With the high voice of the black man riding above the others, no head falsetto here but complete, out of the honest breast, a baritone voice brought over years of woodshedding up to this range. He was bringing brown girls to sashay among these nervous Protestants, down the ancient paths the music had set. Big and little Anita, Stiletto May, Plungette, who loves it between her tits and will do it that way for free, not to mention the Latin. The German? In an English church? These are not heresies so much as imperial outcomes. Necessary as the black man's presence, from acts of minor surrealism, which, taken in the mass, are an act of suicide, but which, in its pathology, in its dreamless version of the real, the empire commits by the thousands every day, completely unaware of what it's doing. So the pure countertenor voice was soaring, finding its way in to Boyd Jessica's heart, and even Roger's, she guessed, risking glances at his face sideways and up through brown ghosts of her hair during recitatifs or releases. He wasn't looking nihilistic, not even cheaply so. He was... No, Jessica's never seen his face exactly like this. In the light of a few hanging oil lamps, the flames unguttering and very yellow, on the nearest the verger's two long fingerprints in fine pollen V for victory up around the belly of the glass. Roger's skin more child pink, his eyes more glowing than the lamplight alone can account for, isn't it? Or is that how she wants it to be? The church is as cold as the night outside. There's the smell of damp wool, of bitter on the breaths of these professionals, of candle smoke and melting wax, of smothered farting, of hair tonic, of the burning oil itself, folding the other odors in a maternal way more closely belonging to earth, to deep strata, other times. And listen, listen, this is the war's evensong, the war's canonical hour, and the night is real. Black greatcoats crowd together, empty hoods full of dense church interior shadows. Over on the coast, the wrens work late, down inside cold and gutted shells. Their blue torches are newborn stars in the tidal evening. Hull plates swing in the sky like great iron leaves, on cables that creak in splinters of sound. At ease, on standby, the flames of the torches, softened, fill the round glass faces of the gauges with apricot light. In the pipe fitters' sheds, icicled, rattling when the gales are in the straits, here's thousands of old used toothpaste tubes, heaped often to the ceilings, thousands of somber man mournings made tolerable, transformed to mint fumes and bleak song that left white spots across the quicksilver mirrors from Harrow to Gravesend, thousands of children who pestled foam up out of soft mortars of mouths, who lost easily 1,000 times as many words among the chalky bubbles, bed-going complaints, timid announcements of love, news of fat or translucent, fuzzy or gentle beings from the country under the counterpane, uncounted soapy licorice moments spat and flushed down to sewers and the slow scumming gray estuary, the morning mouths growing with the day tobacco and fish-furred, dry with fear, foul with idleness, flooded at thoughts of impossible meals, settling instead for the week's offal in gland pies, household milk, broken biscuits at half the usual points, and isn't menthol a marvelous invention to take just enough of it away each morning, down to become dusty, oversized bubbles, tessellating tough and stagnant among the tar shorelines. The intricate draftsmanship of outlets feeding, multiplying out to sea as one by one these old toothpaste tubes are emptied and returned to the war. Heaps of dimly fragrant metal, phantoms of peppermint in the winter shacks, each tube wrinkled or embossed by the unconscious hands of London, written over in interference patterns, hand against hand, waiting now, it is true return, to be melted for solder, for plate, alloyed for castings, bearings, gasketry, hidden smoke shriek linings the children of that other domestic incarnation will never see. Yet the continuity, flesh to kindred metals, home to hedgeless sea, has persisted. It is not death that separates these incarnations, but paper, paper specialties, paper routines. The war, the empire, will expedite such barriers between our lives. The war needs to divide this way and to subdivide, though its propaganda will always stress unity, alliance, pulling together. The war does not appear to want a folk consciousness, not even of the sort the Germans have engineered, ein Volk, ein Führer. It wants a machine of many separate parts, not oneness, but a complexity. Yet who can presume to say what the war wants? So vast and aloof is it, so absentee. Perhaps the war isn't even an awareness, not a life at all, really. There may only be some cruel accidental resemblance to life. At the White Visitation, there's a long-time Skits, you know, who believes that he is World War II. He gets no newspapers, refuses to listen to the wireless, but still, the day of the Normandy invasion, somehow his temperature shot up to 104 degrees. Now, as the pincers east and west continue their slow reflex contraction, he speaks of darkness invading his mind, of an attrition of self. The Rundstedt offensive perked him up, though, gave him a new lease on life. A beautiful Christmas gift, he confessed to the resident on his ward. It's the season of birth, of fresh beginnings. Whenever the rockets fall, those which are audible, he smiles, turns out to pace the ward, tears about to splash from the corners of his merry eyes, caught up in a ruddy, high tonicity that can't help cheering his fellow patients. His days are numbered. He's to die on VE Day. If he's not, in fact, the war, then he's its child surrogate, living high for a certain term, but come the ceremonial day, look out. The true king only dies a mock death, remember. Any number of young men may be selected to die in his place while the real king, foxy old bastard, goes on. Will he show up under the star, slyly genuflecting with the other kings as this winter solstice draws on us? Bring to the Serai gifts of tungsten, cordite, high octane? Will the child gaze up from his ground of golden straw then, gaze into the eyes of the old king who bends long and unfurling overhead, leans to proffer his gift? Will the eyes meet, and what message, what possible greeting or entente will flow between the king and the infant prince? Is the baby smiling or is it just gas? Which do you want it to be? Advent blows from the sea, which at sunset tonight shone green and smooth as iron-rich glass, blows daily upon us, all the sky above pregnant with saints and slender heralds' trumpets. Another year of wedding dresses abandoned in the heart of winter, never called for, hanging in quiet satin ranks now, their white crumpled veils begun to yellow, rippling slightly only at your passing. Spectator, visitor to the city at all the dead ends, glimpsing in the gowns your own reflection once or twice, halfway from shadow, only blurred flesh colors across the peau de soie, urging you in to where you can smell the mildew's first horrible touch, which was really the idea, covering all trace of her own smell, middle-class bride-to-be perspiring, genteel soap and powder. But virgin in her heart, in her hopes. None of your bright Swiss or crystalline season here, but darkly billowed in the day with cloud and the snow falling like gowns in the country, gowns of the winter, gentle at night, a nearly windless breathing around you. In the stations of the city, the prisoners are back from Indochina, wandering their poor visible bones, light as dreamers or men on the moon, among chrome-sprung prams of black hide, resonant as drumheads. Blonde wood high chairs, pink and blue with scraped and mush-spattered floral decals, folding cots and bears with red felt tongues, baby blankets making bright pastel clouds in the coal and stream smells, the metal spaces among the queued, the drifting, the warily asleep, come by their hundreds in for the holidays, despite the warnings, the gravity of Mr. Morrison, the tube under the river a German rocket may pierce now, even now as the words are set down, the absences that may be waiting them, the city addresses that surely can no longer exist. The eyes from Burma, from Tonkin, watch these women at their hundred perseverances, stare out of blued orbits through headaches no alicils can ease. Italian PWs curse underneath the mail sacks that are puffing, echo-making in now each hour in seasonal swell, clogging the snowy train loads like mushrooms, as if the trains have been all night underground, passing through the country of the dead. If these Itais sing now and then, you can bet it's not Giovinezza, but something probably from Rigoletto or La Bohème. Indeed, the post office is considering issuing a list of non-acceptable songs with ukulele chords as an aid to ready identification. their cheer and songfulness, this lot is genuine up to a point, but as the days pile up, as this orgy of Christmas greeting crows daily beyond healthy limits, with no containment in sight before Boxing Day, they settle themselves for being more professionally Italian, rolling the odd eye at the lady evacuees, finding techniques of balancing the sack with one hand whilst the other goes playing dead, cioè conditionally alive, where the crowds thicken most feminine, directionless, well, most promising. Life has to go on. Both kinds of prisoner recognize that, but there's no mano morto for the Englishman back from CBI, no leap from dead to living at mere permission from a likely haunch or thigh, no play, for God's sake, about life and death. They want no more adventures, only the old Dutch fussing over the old stove or warming the old bed, cricketers in the wintertime. They want the semi-detached Sunday dead-leaf somnolence of a dried garden. If the brave new world should also come about, a kind of windfall, why, there'll be time to adjust, certainly, to that. But they want the nearly post-war luxury this week of buying an electric train set for the kid, trying that way each to light his own set of sleek little faces here, calibrating his strangeness, well-known photographs all, brought to life now, oohs and ahs, but not yet, not here in the station, any of the moves most necessary. The war has shunted them, earthed them, those heedless, destroying signalings of love. The children have unfolded last year's toys and found reincarnated spam tins. Their hep this may be the other, and, who knows, unavoidable side to the Christmas game. In the months between country springs and summers, they played with real spam tins, tanks, tank destroyers, pillboxes, dreadnoughts deploying meat pink, yellow and blue about the dusty floors of lumber rooms or butteries, under the cots or couches of their exile. Now it's time again. The plaster baby, the oxen frosted with gold leaf, and the human-eyed sheep are turning real again. Paint quickens to flesh. To believe is not a price they pay. It happens all by itself. He is the new baby. On the magic night before, the animals will talk, and the sky will be milk. The grandparents, who've waited each week for the radio doctor asking, what are piles, what is emphysema, what is a heart attack, will wait up beyond insomnia, watching again for the yearly impossible not to occur, but with some mean residue. This is the hillside. The sky can show us a light, like a thrill, a good time you wanted too much. Not a complete loss, but still too far short of a miracle. Keeping their sweatered and shawled vigils, theatrically bitter, but with the residue inside going through a new winter fermentation every year, each time a bit less, but always good for a revival at this season. All but naked now, the shiny suits and gowns of their pub-crawling primes long torn to strips for lagging the hot water pipes and heaters of landlords, strangers, for holding the houses' identities against the winter. The war needs coal. They have taken the next-to-last steps, attended the radio doctor's certifications of what they knew in their bodies, and at Christmas they are naked as geese under this woolen, murky, cheap old people's swaddling. Their electric clocks run fast. Even Big Ben will be fast now, until the new springs run, all fast, and no one else seems to understand or to care. The war needs electricity. It's a lively game, electric monopoly, among the power companies, the Central Electricity Board, and other war agencies to keep grid time synchronized with Greenwich Mean Time. In the night, the deepest concrete wells of night, dynamos whose locations are classified spin faster, and so, responding, the clock hands next to all the old sleepless eyes, gathering in their minutes, whining, pitching higher toward the vertigo of a siren. It is the night's mad carnival. There is merriment under the shadows of the minute hands. Hysteria in the pale faces between the numerals. The power companies speak of loads, war drains, so vast the clocks will slow again unless this nighttime march is stolen. But the loads expected daily do not occur, and the grid runs inching ever faster, and the old faces turn to the clock faces, thinking plot. And the numbers go whirling toward the nativity of violence, a nova of heart that will turn us all, change us forever to the very forgotten roots of who we are. But over the sea, the fog tonight still is quietly scalloped pearl. Up in the city, The arc lamps crackle, furious, in smothered blaze up the center lines of the streets, too ice-colored for candles, too chill-dropleted for Holocaust. The tall red buses sway. All the headlamps, by regulation newly unmasked, now parry, cross, traverse, and blind. Torn great fistfuls of wetness blow by. Desolate as the beaches beneath the nacre fog, whose barbed wire that never knew the inward sting of current, that only lay passive, oxidizing in the night, now weaves like underwater grass, looped, bitter cold, sharp as the scorpion, all the printless sand miles past cruisers abandoned in the last summers of peacetime that once holidayed the old world away, wine and olive grove and pipe smoke evenings away the other side of the war, stripped now to rust axles and brackets, and smelling inside of the same brine as this beach you cannot really walk, because of the war. Up across the downs, past the spotlights where the migrant birds in autumn choked the beams night after night, fatally held till they dropped exhausted out of the sky, a shower of dead birds, the compline worshippers sit in the unheated church, shivering, voiceless as the choir asks, "Where are the joys?" Where else but there where the angels sing new songs and the bells ring out in the court of the king? Ay, ah, strange thousand-year sigh, ay, ah, wären wir da, were we but there. The tired men and their black bellwether reaching as far as they can, as far from their sheep's clothing as the year will let them stray. Come then, leave your war a while, paper or iron war, petrol or flesh. Come in with your love, your fear of losing, your exhaustion with it. All day it's been at you, coercing, jiving, claiming your belief in so much that isn't true. Is that who you are? That vaguely criminal face on your ID card, its soul snatched by the government camera as the guillotine shutter fell? Or maybe just left behind with your heart at the stage door canteen where they're counting the night's take? The Nafi girls, the girls named Eileen, carefully sorting into refrigerated compartments the rubbery maroon organs with their yellow garnishes of fat. Oh, Linda, come here, feel this one. Put your finger down in the ventricle here. Isn't it swoony? It's still going. Everybody you don't suspect is in on this. Everybody but you. The chaplain, the doctor, your mother hoping to hang that gold star, the vapid soprano last night on the home service program. Let's not forget Mr. Noel Coward, so stylish and cute about death and the afterlife. Packing them into the Duchess for the fourth year running. The lads in Hollywood telling us how grand it all is over here, how much fun. Walt Disney causing Dumbo the elephant to clutch to that feather like how many carcasses under the snow tonight among the white-painted tanks. How many hands each frozen around a miraculous medal. Lucky piece of worn bone, half dollar with the grinning sun peering up under Liberty's wispy gown, clutching, dumb, when the 88 fell. What do you think, it's a children's story? There aren't any. The children are away, dreaming. But the Empire has no place for dreams. And it's adults only in here tonight. Here in this refuge with the lamps burning deep. In pre-Cambrian exhalation. Savory as food cooking, heavy as soot. And 60 miles up, the rockets hanging the measureless instant over the black North Sea before the fall, even faster, to orange heat, Christmas star in helpless plunge to earth. Lower in the sky, the flying bombs are out too, roaring like the adversary, seeking whom they may devour. It's a long walk home tonight. Listen to this mock angel singing. Let your communion be at least in listening, even if they are not spokesmen for your exact hopes, your exact darkest terror. Listen. There must have been evensong here long before the news of Christ. Surely for as long as there have been nights bad as this one, something to raise the possibility of another night that could actually, with love and cockcrows, light the path home, banish the adversary, destroy the boundaries between our lands, our bodies, our stories, all false about who we are. For the one night, leaving only the clear way home and the memory of the infant you saw, almost too frail, there's too much shit in these streets. Camels and other beasts stir heavily outside, each hoof a chance to wipe him out, make him only another messiah. And sure somebody's around already taking bets on that one, while here in this town the Jewish collaborators are selling useful gossip to Imperial Intelligence. and the local hookers are keeping the foreskinned invaders happy, charging whatever the traffic will bear, just like the innkeepers who are naturally delighted with this registration thing. And up in the capital, they're wondering, should they, maybe, give everybody a number? Yeah, something to help SPQR record-keeping. And Herod or Hitler, fellas. The chaplains out in the bulge are manly, haggard, hard drinkers. What kind of a world is it? You forgot Roosevelt, Padre, come the voices from the back. The good father can never see them. They harass him, these tempters, even into his dreams. Wendell Willkie, how about Churchill? Harry Pollitt? For a baby to come in tipping those Toledos at 7 pounds, 8 ounces, thinking he's going to redeem it, why, he ought to have his head examined. But on the way home tonight, you wish you'd picked him up, held him a bit. Just held him, very close to your heart, his cheek by the hollow of your shoulder, full of sleep. As if it were you who could somehow save him. For the moment, not caring who you're supposed to be registered as. For the moment, anyway, no longer who the Caesars say you are. O Jesu parvule, nach dir ist mir sauvé. So this pickup group, these exiles and horny kids, sullen civilians called up in their middle age, men fattening despite their hunger, flatulent because of it, pre-ulcerous, hoarse, runny-nosed, red-eyed, sore-throated, piss-swollen men suffering from acute lower backs and all-day hangovers, wishing death on officers they truly hate, men you have seen on foot and smileless in the cities but forgot, men who don't remember you either, knowing they ought to be grabbing a little sleep, not out here performing for strangers, give you this evensong, climaxing now with its rising fragment of some ancient scale. Voices overlapping, three and fourfold, up, echoing, filling the entire hollow of the church. No counterfeit baby, no announcement of the kingdom, not even a try at warming or lighting this terrible night. Only damn us, our scruffy, obligatory little cry, our maximum reach outward, praise be to God, for you to take back to your war address, your war identity, across the snow's footprints and tire tracks, finally to the path you must create by yourself, alone in the dark. Whether you want it or not, whatever seas you have crossed, the way home. Paradoxical phase, when weak stimuli get strong responses. When did it happen? A certain early stage of sleep. You had not heard the mosquitoes and Lancasters tonight en route to Germany, their engines battering apart the sky, shaking and ripping it for a full hour, a few puffs of winter cloud drifting below the steel-riveted underside of the night. Vibrating with the constancy, the terror of so many bombers outward bound. Your own form immobile, mouth breathing, alone face up on a narrow cot next to the wall, so pictureless, chartless, mapless, so habitually blank. Your feet pointed toward a high slit window at the far end of the room. Starlight, the steady sound of the bomber's departure, icy air seeping in. The table littered with broken-spined books, scribbled columns headed Time/stimulus/secretion 30 seconds/remarks. Teacups, saucers, pencils, pens. You slept, you dreamed. Thousands of feet above your face, the steel bombers passed, wave after wave. It was indoors, some great place of assembly. Many people were gathered. In recent days, at certain hours, a round white light, quite intense, has gone sliding along and down in a straight line through the air. Here, suddenly, it appears again, its course linear as always, right to left. But this time it isn't constant. Instead, it lights up brilliantly in short bursts or jangles. The apparition, this time, is taken by those present as a warning. Something wrong. Drastically wrong with the day. No one knew what the round light signified. A commission had been appointed. An investigation underway, the answer tantalizingly close, but now the light's behavior has changed. The assembly adjourns. On seeing the light jangling this way, you begin to wait for something terrible, not exactly an air raid, but something close to that. You look quickly over at a clock. It's 6 on the dot, hands perfectly straight up and down, and you understand that 6 is the hour of the appearance of the light. You walk out into the evening. It's the street before your childhood home, stony, rutted, and cracked, water shining in puddles. You set out to the left. Usually, in these dreams of home, you prefer the landscape to the right, broad night lawns, towered over by ancient walnut trees, a hill, a wooden fence, hollow-eyed horses in a field, a cemetery. Your task in these dreams is often to cross under the trees, through the shadows, before something happens. Often you go into the fallow field just below the graveyard, full of autumn brambles and rabbits, where the gypsies live. Sometimes you fly, but you can never rise above a certain height. You may feel yourself being slowed, coming inexorably to a halt. Not the keen terror of falling, only an interdiction from which there is no appeal. And as the landscape begins to dim out, you know that. But this evening, this 6 o'clock of the round light, you have set out leftward instead. With you is a girl identified as your wife, though you were never married, have never seen her before, yet have known her for years. She doesn't speak. It's just after a rain. Everything glimmers. Edges are extremely clear. Illumination is low and very pure. Small clusters of white flowers peep out wherever you look. Everything blooms. You catch another glimpse of the round light, following its downward slant, a brief blink on and off. Despite the apparent freshness, recent rain, flower life, the scene disturbs you. You try to pick up some fresh odor to correspond to what you see, but cannot. Everything is silent, odorless. Because of the light's behavior, something is going to happen, and you can only wait. The landscape shines, wetness on the pavement, settling a warm kind of hood around the back of your neck and shoulders. You are about to remark to your wife, "This is the most sinister time of evening." But there's a better word than sinister. You search for it. It is someone's name. It waits behind the twilight, the clarity, the white flowers. There comes a light tapping at the door. You sat bolt upright in bed, your heart pounding in fright. You waited for it to repeat and became aware of the many bombers in the sky. Another knock. It was Thomas Gwynhedwy, come down all the way from London with the news about poor Spectro. You slept through the loud squadrons roaring without let-up, but Gwynhedwy's small, reluctant tap woke you. Something like what happens on the cortex of dog during the paradoxical phase. Now, ghosts crowd beneath the eaves. Stretched among snowy soot chimneys, booming over air shafts, too tenuous themselves for sound, dry now forever in this wet gusting, stretched and never breaking, whipped in glassy French curved chase across the rooftops, along the silver downs, skimming where the sea combs freezing into shore. They gather, thicker as the days pass, English ghosts, so many jostling in the nights. Memories unloosening into the winter, seeds that will never take hold, so lost, now only an every so often word, a clue for the living. Foxes, calls Spectro, across astral spaces, the word intended for Mr. Pointsman, who is not present, who won't be told because the few Psi section who are there to hear it get cryptic debris of this sort every sitting. If recorded at all, it finds its way into Milton Gloaming's word-counting project. Foxes, a buzzing echo on the afternoon. Carol Evantier, the white visitation's resident medium, curls thickly tightened across his head, speaking the word foxes out of very red, thin lips. Half of St. Veronica's Hospital in the morning smashed roofless as the old Ick Regis Abbey, powdered as the snow, and poor Spectro picked off, lighted cubbyhole and dark ward, subsumed in the blast, and he never hearing the approach, the sound too late. After the blast, the rocket's ghost calling to ghosts it newly made, then silence. Another event for Roger Mexico, a round-headed pin to be stuck in his map, a square graduating from 2 up to 3 hits, helping fill out the 3's prediction, which lately is being lagged behind. A pin? Not even that, a pinhole in paper that someday will be taken down when the rockets have stopped their falling or when the young statistician chooses to end his count. Paper to be hauled away by the charwomen, torn up, burned. pointsman alone, sneezing helplessly in his dimming bureau, the barking from the kennels flat now and diminished by the cold, shaking his head no. Inside me, in my memory, more than an event, our common mortality, these tragic days. But by now he is shivering, allowing himself to stare across his office space at the book, to remind himself that of an original seven there are now only two left, himself and Thomas Gwenhydwy, tending his poor outpast Stepney. The five ghosts are strung in clear escalation. Pum in a jeep accident, Easterling taken early in a raid by the Luftwaffe, Drummond by German artillery on shelf fire corner, Lamplighter by a flying bomb, and now Kevin Spectro. Auto, bomb, gun, V1 and now V2, and pointsman has no sense but terrors, all his skin aching for the mounting sophistication of this, for the dialectic it seems to imply. Ah, yes, indeed, the mummy's curse, you idiot. Christ, Christ, I'm ready for D-Wing. Now, D-Wing is the White Visitation's cover, still housing a few genuine patients. Few of the Pisces people go near it. The skeleton of regular hospital staff have their own canteen, WCs, sleeping quarters, offices, carrying on as under the old place, suffering the other lot in their midst, just as, for their part, Pisces staff suffer the garden or peacetime madness of D-Wing, only rarely finding opportunity to swap information on therapies or symptoms. Yes, one would expect more of a link. Hysteria is, after all, is it not hysteria? Well, no, come to find out, it's not. How does one feel legitimist and easy for very long about the transition? From conspiracies so mild, so domestic, from the serpent coiled in the teacup, the hand's paralysis or eyes withdrawal at words, words that could frighten that much, to the sort of thing Spectro found every day in his ward, extinguished now, to what pointsman finds in dogs Pyotr, Natasha, Nikolai, Sergei, Katinka, or Pavel Sergeyevich, Varvara Nikolaevna, and then their children, and when it can be read so clearly in the faces of the physicians. Gwenhydwy, inside his fluffy beard, never as impassive as he might have wished. Spectro hurrying away with a syringe for his fox, when nothing can really stop the abreaction of the Lord of the night, unless the blitz stops, rockets dismantle, the entire film runs backward. Fared skin back to sheet steel, back to pigs, to white incandescence, to ore, to earth. But the reality is not reversible. Each fire bloom, followed by blast, then by sound of arrival, is a mockery, how can it not be deliberate, of the reversible process. With each one, the Lord further legitimizes his state, and we who cannot find him even to see come to think of death no more often, really, than before. And with no warning when they will come, and no way to bring them down, pretend to carry on as in blitzless times. When it does happen, we are content to call it chance, or we have been persuaded. There do exist levels where chance is hardly recognized at all. But to the likes of employees such as Roger Mexico, it is music, not without its majesty, this power series, NE to the minus M, large parentheses, 1 plus M square over 2 exclamation mark, plus M cubed over 3 exclamation mark, plus dot dot dot, plus M to the N minus 1 over small parentheses, N minus 1 parentheses closed exclamation mark, closed large parentheses. Terms numbered according to rocket falls per square. The Poisson dispensation ruling not only these annihilations no man can run from, but also cavalry accidents, blood counts, radioactive decay, number of wars per year. Pointsman stands by a window, his own vaguely reflected face blown through with the driven snow outside in the darkening day. Far across the downs cries a train whistle, grainy as late fog. A cock crow, da-da-da-da-da. A long whistle, another crow. Fire at trackside, a rocket, another rocket in the woods or valley. Well, why not renounce the book, then, Ned? Give it up, that's all, the obsolescent data. The master's isolated moments of poetry, it's paper, that's all. You don't need it, the book and its terrible curse, before it's too late. Yes, recant, grovel, oh, fabulous, but before whom? Who's listening? But he has crossed back to the desk and actually laid hands on it. Ass. Superstitious ass. Wandering empty-headed, these episodes are coming more often now, his decline creeping on him like the cold. Pum, Easterling, Drummond, Lamplighter, Spectro, what should he've done then? Gone down to Psi Section, asked Eventyr to get up a seance, try to get on to one of them at least, perhaps. Yes, what holds him back? Have I? He whispers against the glass, the aspirate, the later plosives clouding the cold pane and fans of breath, warm and disconsolate breath. So much pride. He cannot walk down that particular corridor, cannot even suggest, no, not even to Mexico, how he misses them. Though he hardly knew Drummond or Easterling, but misses Alan Lamplighter, who would bet on anything, you know, on dogs, thunderstorms, tram numbers, on street corner, wind, and a likely skirt, on how far a given doodle would get, perhaps, oh God, even the one that fell on him. Pum's arranger-style piano and drunken baritone, his adventuring among the nurses. Spectro, why can't he ask, when there are 100 ways to put it? I should have. There are, in his history, so many of these unmade moves, so many should-haves, should have married her, let her father steer him, should have stayed in Harley Street, been kinder, smiled more at strangers, even smiled back this afternoon at Morty Chilkis. Why couldn't he? A silly, bleeding smile, why not? What inhibits, what snarl of the mosaic? Pretty, amber eyes behind those government spectacles. Women avoid him. He knows in a general way what it is. He's creepy. He's even aware, usually, of the times when he's being creepy. It's a certain set to his face muscles, a tendency to sweat. But he can't seem to do anything about it. Can't ever concentrate for long enough. They distract him so. And next thing he knows, he's back to radiating the old creepiness again. And their response to it is predictable. They run uttering screams only they and he can hear. Oh, but how he'd like some day to give them something really to scream about. Here's an erection stirring. He'll masturbate himself to sleep again tonight. The joyless constant, an institution in his life. But goading him, just before the bright peak, what images will come whirling in? Why, the turrets and blue waters, the sails and church tops of Stockholm, the yellow telegram, the face of a tall, cognizant and beautiful woman turned to watch him as he passes in the ceremonial limousine, a woman who will later, hardly by chance, visit him in his suite at the Grand Hotel. It's not all ruby nipples and black lace cami knickers, you know. There are hushed entrances into rooms that smell of paper, satellite votes on this committee or that, the chairs, the prizes, what could compare? Later, when you're older, you'll know, they said. Yes, and it grows upon him each war year equal to a dozen of peacetime. Oh, my, how right they were. As his luck has always known, his subcortical brute luck, this gift of survival while other and better men are snatched away into death, here's the door, one he's imagined so often in lonely Thessian brushings down his polished corridors of years, an exit out of the orthodox Pavlovian, showing him vistas of Nurmalm, Södermalm, Deer Park, an old city. One by one they are being picked off around him. In his small circle of colleagues, the ratio slowly grows top-heavy. More ghosts, more each winter, and fewer living. And with each one, he thinks he feels patterns on his cortex going dark, settling to sleep forever. Parts of whoever he's been now losing all definition, reverting to dumb chemistry. Kevin Spectro did not differentiate as much as he between outside and inside. He saw the cortex as an interface organ, mediating between the two, but part of them both. When you've looked at how it really is, he asked once, how can we, any of us, be separate? He is my Pierre Janet, Pointsman thought. Soon, by the dialectic of the book, Pointsman will be alone. in a black field, lapsing to isotropy, to the zero, waiting to be last to go. Will there be time? He has to survive, to try for the prize, not for his own glory, no, but to keep a promise to the human field of seven he once was, the ones who didn't make it. Here's a medium shot, himself backlit, alone at the high window in the Grand Hotel, whiskey glass tipped at the bright subarctic sky, and here's to you then, chaps. It'll be all of us up there on stage tomorrow. Ned Pointsman only happened to survive, that's all. To Stockholm, his banner and cry, and after Stockholm, a blur. A long golden twilight. Oh, yes, once, you know, he did believe in a Minotaur waiting for him. Used to dream himself rushing into the last room, burnished sword at the ready, screaming like a commando, letting it all out at last, some true, marvelous peaking of life inside him for the first and last time. As the face turned his way, ancient, weary, seeing none of Pointsman's humanity, ready only to assume him in another long routinized nudge of horn, flip of hoof. But this time there would be struggle. Minotaur blood, the fucking beast, cries from far inside himself whose manliness and violence surprise him. This was the dream. The settings. The face changed. Little of it passed the structure, survived the first cup of coffee and flat beige benzedrine pill. It might be a vast lorry park just at dawn, the pavement newly hosed, mottled in grease browns, the hooded olive trucks standing each with a secret, each waiting. But he knows that inside one of these, and at last, sifting among them, finds it, the identifying code beyond voicing, climbs up into the back under the canvas, waits in the dust and brown light until, through the cloudy oblong of the cab window, a face he knows, begins to turn. But the underlying structure is the turning face, the meeting of eyes. Stalking Reichssieger von Tannatz Alpdrucken, that most elusive of Nazi hounds, champion Weimaraner for 1941, bearing studbook number 416832, tattooed inside his ear along through a Londonized Germany, his liver-gray shape receding, loping at twilight canal sides, strewn with debris of war, rocket blasts, each time missing them, their chase preserved, a plate etched in fireburns, the map of a sacrificial city, of a cortex human and canine, the dog's ear leather mildly aswing, top of his skull brightly reflecting the winter clouds, into a shelter lying steel-clad miles below the city, an opera of Balkan intrigue, in whose hermetic safety, among whose clusters of blue dissonance unperiodically stressed, he's unable to escape completely because of how always the Reichssieger persists, leading, serene, uncancellable, and to the literal pursuit of whom he thus returns, must return time and again in a fever rondo, until at last they are on some hillside at the end of a long afternoon of dispatches from Armageddon, among scarlet bangs of bougainvillea, golden pathways where dust is rising, pillars of smoke far away over the spidery city they've crossed, voices in the air telling of South America burned to cinders, the sky over New York glowing purple with the new all-sovereign death ray. And here at last is where the gray dog can turn and the amber eyes gaze into Ned Pointsman's own. Each time, each turning, his own blood and heart are stroked, beaten, brought jubilantly high, and triggered to the icy Noctiluca to flare and fusing thermite as he begins to expand, an uncontainable light as the walls of the chamber turn a blood glow, orange, then white, and begin to slip, to flow like wax. What there is of labyrinth collapsing in rings outward, hero and horror, engineer and Ariadne consumed, molten inside the light of himself, the mad exploding of himself. Years ago. Dreams he hardly remembers. The intermediaries come long since between himself and his final beast. They would deny him even the little perversity of being in love with his death. But now, with Slothrop in it, sudden angel, thermodynamic surprise, whatever he is, will it change now? Might Pointsman get to have a go at the Minotaur after all? Slothrop ought to be on the Riviera by now, warm, fed, well-fucked. But out in this late English winter, the dogs, thrown over, are still ranging the back streets and mews, sniffing the dustbins, skidding on carpets of snow, fighting, fleeing, shivering in their wet pools of Prussian blue, seeking to avoid what cannot be smelled or seen, what announces itself with the roar of a predator so absolute they sink to the snow whining and roll over to give it their soft and open bellies. Has Pointsman renounced them in favor of one untried human subject? Don't think he hasn't doubts as to the validity of this scheme, at least. Let Vicar de la Nuit worry about its rightness. He's the staff chaplain. But what about the dogs? Pointsman knows them. He's deftly picked the locks of their awareness. They have no secrets. He can drive them mad. And with bromides in adequate doses, he can bring them back. But Slothrop? So the Pavlovian dithers about his office, feeling restless and old. He should sleep, but he can't. It has to be more than the simple conditioning of a child once upon a time. How can he have been a doctor this long and not developed reflexes for certain conditions? He knows better. He knows it is more. Spectro is dead. And Slothrop, sentiment d'emprise, old man, softly now, was with his Darlene, only a few blocks from St. Veronica's 2 days before. When one event happens after another with this awful regularity, of course you don't automatically assume that it's cause and effect. But you do look for some mechanism to make sense of it. You probe. You design a modest experiment. He owes Spectro that much. Even if the American's not legally a murderer, he is sick. The etiology ought to be traced, the treatment found. There is to this enterprise, Pointsman knows, a danger of seduction. Because of the symmetry. He's been led before, you know, down the garden path by symmetry, in certain test results, in assuming that a mechanism must imply its mirror image, irradiation, for example, and reciprocal induction, and who'd ever said that either had to exist? Perhaps it will be so this time, too, but how it haunts him, the symmetry of these two secret weapons, outside, out in the blitz, the sounds of V1 and V2, one the reverse of the other. Pavlov showed how mirror images inside could be confused. Ideas of the opposite. But what new pathology lies outside now? What sickness to events, to history itself, can create symmetrical opposites like these robot weapons? Sign and symptoms. Was Spectro right? Could outside and inside be part of the same field? If only in fairness, Pointsman ought to be seeking the answer at the interface. Oughtn't he? On the cortex of Lieutenant Slothrop. The man will suffer, perhaps in some clinical way, be destroyed, but how many others tonight are suffering in his name? For pity's sake, every day in Whitehall they're weighing and taking risks that make his, in this, seem almost trivial. Almost. There's something here too transparent and swift to get a hold on. Sisection might speak of ectoplasms, but he knows that the time has never been better, and that the exact experimental subject is in his hands. He must seize now or be doomed to the same stone hallways whose termination he knows. But he must remain open, even to the possibility that the Psi people are right. We may all be right, he puts in his journal tonight. So may be all we have speculated and more. Whatever we may find, there can be no doubt that he is, physiologically, historically, a monster. We must never lose control. The thought of him lost in the world of men after the war fills me with a deep dread I cannot extinguish. More and more, these days of angelic visit and communique, Carol Eventyr feels a victim of his freak talent. As Nora Dodson-Truck once called it, his splendid weakness. It showed late in life. He was 35 when, out of the other world, one morning on the embankment, between strokes of a pavement artist's two pastels, salmon darkening to fawn, and a score of lank human figures, rags sorrowful in the distances interlacing with ironwork and river smoke, all at once someone was speaking through Eventyr, so quietly that Nora caught hardly any of it, not even the identity of the soul that took and used him. Not then. Some of it was in German, some of the words she remembered. She would ask her husband, whom she was to meet that afternoon out in Surrey, arriving late, though, all the shadows, men and women, dogs, chimneys very long and black across the enormous lawn, and she with a dusting of ochre, barely noticeable in the late sun, making a fan shape near the edge of her veil. It was that color she'd snatched from the screever's woodbox, and swiftly, turning smoothly, touching only at shoe tip and the creamy block of yellow crumbling onto the surface, never leaving it, drew a great five-pointed star on the pavement, just upriver, from an unfriendly likeness of Lloyd George in heliotrope and sea green. Pulling Evantyr by the hand to stand inside the central pentagon, seagulls in a wailing diadem overhead, then stepping in herself, an instinctive, a motherly way, her way with anyone she loved. She'd drawn her pentagram not even half in play. One couldn't be too safe. There was always evil. Had he felt her even then beginning to recede, called up the control from across the wall as a way of holding on? She was deepening from his waking, his social eye like light at the edge of the evening when, for perhaps a perilous 10 minutes, nothing helps. Put on your glasses and light lamps. Sit by the west window and still it keeps going away. You keep losing the light and perhaps it is forever this time. A good time of day for learning surrender. Learning to diminish like the light or like certain music. This surrender is his only gift. Afterward he can recall nothing. Sometimes, rarely, there may be tantalizing, not words, but halos of meaning around words his mouth evidently spoke, that only stay behind, if they do, for a moment, like dreams, can't be held or developed, and presently go away. He's been under Rollo Grost's EEG countless times since first he came to the White Visitation, and all's normal adult except for, oh, once or twice, perhaps, a stray 50 millivolt spike off a temporal lobe. Now left, now right, really no pattern to it. Indeed, a kind of Canals of Mars controversy has been in progress for these years among the different observers. Aaron Throster swears he's seen slow delta wave shapes out of the left frontal and suspects a tumor. Last summer, Edwin Treacle noted a subdued petit mal spike and wave alternation, curiously much slower than the usual 3 per second. Though admittedly, Treacle was up in London all the night before, debauching with Alan Lamplighter and his gambling crowd. Less than a week later, the buzz bomb gave Lamplighter his chance to find Evantyr from the other side and prove to him to be what others had said, an interface between the worlds, a sensitive. Lamplighter had suffered 5-2 odds, but so far he's been silent. Nothing in the soft acetate-slash-metal discs or typed transcripts that mightn't be any of a dozen other souls. They've come in their time from as far away as the Institute at Bristol to gape at, to measure and systematically doubt the freaks of Psi Section. Here's Ronald Cherrycoke, the noted psychometrist, eyes lightly fluttering, hands a steady inch away framing the brown-wrapped box in which are securely hidden certain early war mementos, a dark maroon cravat, a broken Schaefer fountain pen, a tarnished pince-nez of white gold, all belonging to a group Captain Basher St. Blaise stationed far away north of London. As this Cherrycoke, a normal-looking lad, perhaps a bit overweight, begins now to recite, in his lathe-humming Midland accents, an intimate resume of the group captain, his anxieties about his falling hair, his enthusiasm over the Donald Duck cinema cartoons, an incident during the Lübeck raid which only he and his wingman, now passed on, shared and agreed not to report. Nothing that violated security. Confirmed later, in fact, by St. Blaise himself, smiling a bit open-mouthed, "Well, the joke's certainly on me, and now tell me, how'd you do it?" Indeed, how does Cherrycoke do it? How do any of them? How does Margaret Quartertone produce voices on discs and wire recorders miles distant without speaking or physically touching the equipment? And what speakers are now beginning to assemble? Where are the 5-digit groups coming from which the Reverend Dr. Paul de la Nuit, chaplain and staff automatist, has been writing for weeks now, and which, it is felt ominously, no one up in London quite knows how to decrypt? What do Edwin Treacle's recent dreams of flight mean, especially as time correlated with Nora Dodson Truck's dreams of falling? What gathers among them all that each in his own freak way can testify to, but not in language, not even the lingua franca of the offices? Turbulences in the ether, uncertainties out in the winds of karma. Those souls across the interface, those we call the dead, are increasingly anxious and evasive. Even Carol Evantyr's own control, the habitually cool and sarcastic Peter Saxa, the one who found him that day long ago on the embankment and thereafter whenever there are messages to be passed across, even Saxa's become nervous. Lately, as if all tuned in to the same ethereal Ext program, new varieties of freak have been showing up at the White Visitation, all hours of the day and night, silent, staring, expecting to be taken care of, carrying machines of black metal and glass gingerbread off on waxy trances, hyperkinetically waiting only the right trigger question to start blithering 200 word a minute about their special terrible endowments. An assault. What are we to make of Gavin Trefoyle, for whose gift there's not even a name yet? Rollo Grost wants to call it autochromatism. Gavin, the youngest here, only 17, can somehow metabolize at will one of his amino acids, tyrosine. This will produce melanin, which is the brown-black pigment responsible for human skin color. Gavin can also inhibit this metabolizing by, it appears, varying the level of his blood phenylalanine. So he can change his color from most ghastly albino up through a smooth spectrum to very deep purplish black. If he concentrates, he can keep this up at any level for weeks. Usually, he is distracted or forgets and gradually drifts back to his rest state, a pale, freckled redhead's complexion. But you can imagine how useful he was to Gerhard von Gerl during the shooting of the Schwarz Kommando footage. He helped save literally hours of makeup and lighting work, acting as a variable reflector. The best theory of how is Rollo's, but it's hopelessly vague. We do know that the dermal cells which produce melanin, the melanocytes, were once in each of us, at an early stage of embryonic growth, part of the central nervous system. But as the embryo grows, as tissue goes on differentiating, some of these nerve cells move away from what will be the CNS and migrate out to the skin to become melanocytes. They keep their original tree branch shapes, the axon and dendrites of the typical nerve cell, but the dendrites are used now to carry not electric signals, but skin pigment. Rollo Grost believes in some link, so far undiscovered, some surviving cell memory that will, retrocolonial, still respond to messages from the metropolitan brain. Messages that young Trefoyle may not consciously know of. It is part, Rollo writes home to the elder Dr. Grost in Lancashire, in elaborate revenge for childhood tales of Jenny Greenteeth waiting out in the fens to drown him, part of an old and clandestine drama for which the human body serves only as a set of very elusive, often cryptic program notes. It's as if the body we can measure is a scrap of this program found outside in the street near a magnificent stone theater we cannot enter. The convolutions of language denied us. The great stage, even darker than Mr. Tyrone Guthrie's accustomed murk, gilt and mirroring red velvet tier on tier of box seats, all in shadows too, as somewhere down in that deep proscenium, deeper than geometries we know of, the voices utter secrets we are never told. Everything that comes out from CNS we have to file here, you see. It gets to be a damned nuisance after a while. Most of it's utterly useless, but you never know when they'll want something. Middle of the night, or during the worst part of an ultraviolet bombardment, you know, it makes no difference to them back there. Do you ever get out much to, well, up to the outer level? A long pause in which the older operative stares quite openly as several changes flow across her features, amusement, pity, concern, until the younger one speaks again. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be... Abruptly. I'm supposed to tell you eventually as part of the briefing. Tell me what? Just as I was told once. We hand it on, one generation to the next. There is no piece of business plausible enough for her to find refuge in. We sense that this has not yet become routine for her. Out of decency now, she tries to speak quietly, if not gently. We all go up to the outer level, young man. Some immediately, others not for a while. But sooner or later, everyone out here has to go epidermal. No exceptions. Has to. I'm sorry, but isn't it... I thought it was only a... Well, a level, a place you'd visit, isn't it?
Outlandish scenery, oh yes, so did I. Unusual formations, a peep into the outer radiance. But it's all of us, you see. Millions of us changed to interface, to horn and no feeling and silence. Oh, God. A pause in which he tries to take it in, then, in panic, pushes it back. No, how can you say that? You can't feel the memory? The tug. We're in exile. We do have a home. Silence from the other. Back there. Not up at the interface. Back in the CNS. Quietly. It's been a prevalent notion. Fallen sparks, fragments of vessels broken at the creation, and someday, somehow, before the end, a gathering back to home. A messenger from the kingdom arriving at the last moment. But I tell you, there is no such message, no such home. Only the millions of last moments, no more. Our history is an aggregate of last moments. She crosses the complex room, dense with its supple hides, lemon-rubbed teak, rising snarls of incense, bright optical hardware, faded Central Asian rugs in gold and scarlet, hanging open-ribbed wrought ironwork, a long, long downstage cross eating an orange, section by acid section, as she goes, the fale gown flowing beautifully, its elaborate sleeves falling from very broadened shoulders, till tightly gathered into long, button-strung cuffs all in some nameless earth tone, a hedge green, a clay brown, a touch of oxidation, a breath of the autumnal. The light from the street lamps comes in through philodendron stalks and fingered leaves arrested in a grasp at the last straining away of sunset. Falls a tranquil yellow across the cut steel buckles at her insteps and streaks on along the flanks and down the tall heels of her patent shoes, so polished as to seem of no color at all past such mild citrus light where it touches them, and they refuse it, as if it were a masochist's kiss. Behind her steps, the carpet relaxes ceilingward, sole and heel shapes disappearing visibly slow out of the wool pile. A single rocket explosion comes thudding across the city, from far east of here, east by southeast. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.